Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Hello and welcome. This is News Director Richard Spezak of Progressive News Network. We have a very serious show today. This show is a tribute to Private Bradley Manning and also to all the whistleblowers who have run afoul of this Democratic administration, who's prosecuted more whistleblowers than any other administration in recent history. Bradley Manning is alleged to have passed information that he was privy to as an officer, and he's passed it allegedly to people who got it to WikiLeaks. Now, a principle was established in our military many years ago that it is, in fact, acceptable to refuse orders that are unlawful, and to pass information on about unlawful orders up the chain of command. And Mr. Manning allegedly did try to pass the information he had up the chain of command. He complained about the treatment of Iraqis. He complained about the torture. He complained about the casual nature that was used to guide the selection of people to be incarcerated over there. And he allegedly released information that got into the hands of WikiLeaks and was published and then republished by newspapers across the world. Now, just so that you have some context for this information, the famous whistleblower, decades ago, Daniel Ellsberg, and the famous Pentagon Papers, those materials were top secret. A much higher classification of information. And, of course, we've all heard the stories about the overclassification where items that are merely embarrassing get deemed top secret to protect or cover the ass of the stupid, of the incompetent, or of the greedy. So if Bradley Manning is, in fact, the person that released this information, including the collateral damage video, then he has done a service to us in this country. And I urge you to look into how many whistleblowers have been punished. And it's not a pretty sight. But first thing I want to do is I want to play an interview with Nathan Fuller of the Bradley Manning Support Network. He'll put this in perspective and bring us up to date. And I'd like to welcome a guest, Mr. Nathan Fuller. Nathan, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
It's so important right now that people become aware of what's being done in the name of this great country. We have some wonderful ideals. We have wonderful documents that espouse our goals as a free people. And yet, too often, justice is not meted out equitably. And we're going to talk about the case of Private Bradley Manning. Nathan, could you tell us where the trial stands right now?
Yep. So we're nearing the end of the pretrial hearing phase. Bradley has had pretrial hearings about every month since December 2011, and his court-martial trial is scheduled to begin June 3rd of this year, which will have just be about just over 3 years after he was arrested in May of 2010. And he currently still faces these 22 counts, which would put him in life, put him in prison for life, namely aiding the enemy indirectly and the under the Espionage Act.
It's for true. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Just for passing for those who don't know, classified documents to WikiLeaks.
Now, there's been, of course, all kinds of charges, countercharges, statements in the media this way and that way. Many of us know that the president characterized the treatment of Private Manning as fair, and he also at one point early on in the situation declared him guilty way before any kind of trial had been even begun. And of course, many of us know that the type of incarceration he was suffering changed dramatically. Could you talk a little bit about that change in how he's been held and the change of conditions of his incarceration?
Sure. So upon arrest, Bradley was put into a solitary metal cage in Kuwait for over a month, and then he was moved to Quantico Marine Brig in Virginia, where he was held in solitary confinement for over 9 months, and conditions that the UN torture rapporteur called cruel, inhuman, and degrading. He was deprived of his clothing at some points. He was deprived of basic hygiene items just because they said that he was a suicide risk or a potential harm to himself, even though a Brig psychiatrist said that he was at no risk or low risk. And so they kept him in solitary confinement for more than 9 months. And after international outrage and the UN investigation and lots of protests at Quantico, he was finally moved to Fort Leavenworth in Kansas, where he currently is confined and is in medium security, much better conditions.
Well, thank goodness for that. Isn't it true also that he was not permitted to sleep for more than 5 minutes at a time during much of that confinement at Quantico?
Well, during the day, he was questioned every 5 minutes. He was allowed to sleep more than 5 minutes, but there was a giant light blaring into his room, and if he ever covered his face, he was woken up. But during the day, he was checked on every 5 minutes, asked if he was okay. It's really just kind of psychological torture. It
sure.
Was less physical, but it was psychological, intended to break him down, and it intended to make an example out of him.
And now there's been some confusion about what, if anything, he has talked about releasing. There was some talk about downloading data while he was supposedly listening to Lady Gaga. Of course, many of us have heard about the video footage of that helicopter attack. Could you clear up those details for us? Has he admitted to releasing any of those particular pieces, or it's just kind of all under the broad brush of the WikiLeaks release?
Well, if you look at the chat logs that he had with Adrian Lamo that were released by Wired, he did talk about, and those have not been confirmed, but we are to believe that those are accurate as far. He did talk about things like the State Department cables. He talked about the way the U.S. does business in secret, the way the first world exploits the third. And sometimes that's through outright criminal activities, and sometimes it's more subtle, pernicious influence or corporate influence than otherwise. So he did talk about some of the specific things. He talked about Iraqi detainee policies that he disagreed with in Iraq when he was in Baghdad, and he brought those up with his superiors, and they told him to basically shut up and keep doing your job, and that was something he felt like he could not continue to be complicit in.
And isn't it true that the American military code allows for if a soldier is... I'm going to stop that for a minute and bring on one of our activist guests. Good afternoon and welcome.
Oh, Brian Stenton here.
Hi, Richard. Brian. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing pretty good. Well, outside of a head cold. How is everybody doing on your end?
Pretty good. I wanted to get your reaction to some of the issues regarding the Bradley Manning. He's been incarcerated for 1,000 days now, still no trial. What's your reflection on this matter, sir?
Well, it's more signs that we're becoming more and more of a totalitarian state, which shouldn't be too shocking because corporate power is by its very nature totalitarian, right? I mean, a corporation, you have a CEO dictator. Orders are taken from the top and passed on below, and you rent yourselves to it, and you call it making a living. We have more and more corporate power controlling our politics, and it sort of reflects in all aspects of our life. The media overall maintains a very uniform message. Any message that's outside of a very narrow political spectrum that's discussed is suppressed. The information that Bradley Manning put forth was definitely outside of that spectrum. It suggested that the United States committed war crimes, or the WikiLeaks cables from the embassies. They were especially telling because they suggested that the U.S. State Department was basically a contractor for big business interests. You don't really want that message out to the American people. They suppress it.
Now, you're a small businessman also. Has the State Department pulled some strings overseas to make sure that you profited over there?
Me personally? I sell internet advertising, but
Let me ask you this. We've seen an awful lot of whistleblowers prosecuted. Do you have any concerns about that?
Yeah, I think it's going to continue to get worse. As I said, we're becoming more and more totalitarian as time goes on, without a doubt. For example, going back to the WikiLeaks cables, one of the cables that we had from Bradley Manning was regarding Haiti. It was made very clear that various sweatshop companies, such as a jeans manufacturer, Levi Strauss, or underwear maker, Fruit of the Loom, didn't like Aristide raising the minimum wage. So they approached the Bush administration to pressure the removal of Aristide. And that was a WikiLeaks story that was published, I think, simultaneously in one of our papers, as well as Haiti Libre. And basically it shows what our State Department is. It's basically, it acts as a contractor for big business. It doesn't help small businesses. Only the large monopolistic businesses that strongly influence our society.
There were also WikiLeaks documents related to making sure that GM crops were not hampered over in Europe.
Yeah, it's all across the industrial spectrum, right? So, basically, big business interests controls our society. They call it democracy. If you go back to the Iraq War and remember the talks about, we're bringing democracy to Iraq, and we sort of laugh at the idea. But, in the minds of the elite, they are bringing democracy. Their concept of democracy is a society that's run by big business or a society that's friendly to United States big business. That's called democracy. And if you look at that definition of democracy, then all our policy makes absolute sense. But if it runs counter to that, then enemy.
Do you think there's any chance that Mr. Manning will get justice?
I don't know. It depends on grassroots activism. There's been plenty of it, but it's been pretty much blocked out by the mainstream media.
Well, I think you can say on the plus side that the activists were part of what changed his incarceration conditions. He was moved finally from the brig. And I understand that some of those people in charge of his being held actually admitted wrongdoing after he was released.
Yeah. So, some positives are coming. We'll see what happens. But, there's excellent organizations out there that are making people aware of the situation. Yeah, so more of that.
Well, thank you so much, Brian, for weighing in on this. It's a crucial issue of our time, and more people should be aware of it because the next whistleblower that gets harassed might be one we need.
Thanks for having me on.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
And I'd like to welcome a guest, Mr. Nathan Fuller. Nathan, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
It's so important right now that people become aware of what's being done in the name of this great country. We have some wonderful ideals. We have wonderful documents that espouse our goals as a free people. And yet, too often, justice is not meted out equitably. And we're going to talk about the case of Private Bradley Manning. Nathan, could you tell us where the trial stands right now?
Yep. So we're nearing the end of the pretrial hearing phase. Bradley has had pretrial hearings about every month since December 2011, and his court-martial trial is scheduled to begin June 3rd of this year, which will have just be about just over 3 years after he was arrested in May of 2010. And he currently still faces these 22 counts, which would put him in prison for life, namely aiding the enemy indirectly and under the Espionage Act.
It's for true. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Just for passing, for those who don't know, classified documents to WikiLeaks.
Now, there's been, of course, all kinds of charges, counter charges, statements in the media this way and that way. Many of us know that the president characterized the treatment of Private Manning as fair. And he also, at one point early on in the situation, declared him guilty way before any kind of trial had been even begun. And, of course, many of us know that the type of incarceration he was suffering changed dramatically. Could you talk a little bit about that change in how he's been held and the change of conditions of his incarceration?
Sure. So upon arrest, Bradley was put into a solitary metal cage in Kuwait for over a month, and then he was moved to Quantico Marine Brig in Virginia, where he was held in solitary confinement for over 9 months, and conditions that the UN torture rapporteur called cruel, inhuman, and degrading. He was deprived of his clothing at some points. He was deprived of basic hygiene items just because they said that he was a suicide risk or a potential harm to himself, even though a brave psychiatrist said that he was at no risk or low risk. And so they kept him in solitary confinement for more than 9 months, and after international outrage and the UN investigation and lots of protests at Quantico, he was finally moved to Fort Leavenworth in Kansas, where he currently is confined and is in medium security, much better conditions.
Well, thank goodness for that. Isn't it true also that he was not permitted to sleep for more than 5 minutes at a time during much of that confinement at Quantico?
Well, during the day, he was questioned every 5 minutes. He was allowed to sleep more than 5 minutes, but there was a giant light blaring into his light and into his room, and if he ever covered his face, he was woken up. But during the day, he was checked on every 5 minutes, asked if he was okay. It's really just kind of psychological torture. It
sure.
Was less physical, but it was psychological, intended to break him down, and it intended to make an example out of him.
And now there's been some confusion about what, if anything, he has talked about releasing. There was some talk about downloading data while he was supposedly listening to Lady Gaga. Of course, many of us have heard about the video footage of that helicopter attack. Could you clear up those details for us? Has he admitted to releasing any of those particular pieces, or it's just kind of all under the broad brush of the WikiLeaks release?
Well, if you look at the chat logs that he had with Adrian Lamo that were released by Wired, he did talk about, and those have not been confirmed, but we are to believe that those are accurate as far. He did talk about things like the State Department cables. He talked about the way the U.S. does business in secret, the way the First World exploits the Third. And sometimes that's through outright criminal activities, and sometimes it's more subtle, pernicious influence or corporate influence than otherwise. So he did talk about some of the specific things. He talked about Iraqi detainee policies that he disagreed with in Iraq. But when he was in Baghdad and he brought those up with his superiors and they told him to basically shut up and keep doing your job, and that was something he felt like he could not continue to be complicit in.
And isn't it true that the American military code allows for if a soldier is asked to do something that he deems illegal, they do have a chance, an opportunity to speak up. Isn't that true?
Well, ostensibly they do, but you see what happens when they try to exercise that right. Bradley was, in his words, told just to shut up, to keep quiet, to keep doing what he's doing, keep getting more of these detainees with the policy he didn't agree with. Basically, Iraq was detaining civilians just for passing out passing out pretty innocuous literature saying just get money out of politics, and he felt that was egregious. He brought that up with his chain of command, and which is supposed to be the structure that keeps others accountable and provides oversight. But when he brought that up, he was told to shut up, so it didn't really function the way the military says it's supposed to.
Sure.
And that's why we need these alternative outlets such as WikiLeaks, because people are not going to hear about it otherwise.
Yes, there's been very little coverage in what's called the commercial mainstream media. Isn't it also true that Daniel Ellsberg has characterized the material that he leaked as at a higher, much higher level of secrecy?
Yep, and the military does the same. What the Pentagon Papers are what Ellsberg released, and those were top secret. Everything Bradley's accused of leaking is secret or lower. Some of it is even unclassified, but the military continues to allege that it contains national security or national defense information that was closely held, even if it's not classified. But yeah, it's all lower than top secret.
And isn't it also true that the military and the State Department as well are on record as saying that none of this was critical material?
There have been varying statements, but there's no indication that we've seen that these have caused any kind of harm that the State Department is warning about or is fear-mongering about, rather. And in fact, the government in court has not tried to deny the fact that these releases have not caused harm. Instead, they have removed that discussion from the court. They have said that the defense cannot talk about whether or not WikiLeaks releases caused any harm. They only talk about whether or not it was illegal to leak them. And so that's that shows you, you know, these documents really should not have been classified in the first place if they're not causing any harm.
And there has been a degree of harassment of people who've been involved in trying to help Private Manning. Isn't that the case?
Certainly. David House, a friend and a longtime supporter of Private Manning, stopped at the border and had his electronics seized and searched without his permission. I believe Jacob Applebaum, who supported WikiLeaks and might have worked for them, has been stopped at the border and interrogated and had his items seized, I believe. And Birgitta Jonsdottir, an Icelandic MP, has feared traveling to the U.S., although she's risking that danger to come to the United States in April to support Bradley Manning.
So there's a call for events across the country on Saturday the 23rd. Isn't that the case?
That is, although some events are happening today and Sunday, and some are actually already underway, such as some in Australia. There are events in over 60 cities now on 5 different continents. We have dozens of cities across the U.S., several in Europe, Australia, even in Africa. People are marking Bradley's 1,000th day in confinement without trial, and ironically, just next week, Judge Denise Lind is going to rule on the defense's motion to dismiss charges for lack of a speedy trial. The government still says it's given Bradley a speedy trial and has acted diligently, but it's been nearly 3 years now and we have not even gone to trial.
As I understand it, there's hearings scheduled for, is it May?
We have a hearing next week, actually, February 26th through March 1st. And then we have one April 10th to 12th, one May 21st to the 24th, and then we have the trial scheduled for June 3rd.
June 3rd, okay. Let me ask you this, and again, a kind of broader context. We see the Bush administration, who took this country to war under guise of falsehoods, knowingly, it seems. We see war criminals, certainly polluters, and certainly Wall Street bankers walking away scot-free. Why do you think our country is suddenly focused in and is punishing so many whistleblowers?
Well, that is the big picture, and that's the terrible dichotomy we have. These massive criminals, these big banks who are ruining the economy and the entire administration that oversaw torture and illegal war, unjust war, have all been let go. And it's pretty sad. I don't know, whistleblowers are aggressively attacked. This administration calls itself the most transparent ever, and yet is attacking those who want to make information free. I think it's a clear sign we're going in the wrong direction.
If you were going to give a message to people who are concerned about this excessive prosecution of whistleblowers, and especially in Private Manning's case, what would you tell people they can do? How can they help?
Well, they can certainly join the activities this weekend. A lot of people there are showing a good example of what you can do. You can make noise about it. It's hard to do something within the legal system for the supporters around the world. But they can make their protests loud. They can make it politically unpopular to continue treating Bradley Manning this way or to try him at all. A lot of us believe that he shouldn't even be on trial, and we should be thanking him and not prosecuting him. And you can also go to bradleymanning.org. You can stay updated on the case with our newsletter. You can find out a lot more about how to hold a rally or an event in your area. And we can provide materials and information about that. So yeah, definitely BradleyManning.org has a lot of information, a lot of stuff you need to know.
Thank you so much, Mr. Fuller. We certainly appreciate it, and we are with you in support of Private Manning. Let's hope that his case comes to a speedy resolve and he gets the reward that he deserves, not the punishment that some would mete out. Thank you again, sir.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Have a good day.
That was Nathan Fuller.
And that was Nathan Fuller of the Bradley Manning Organization. It's a critical time in our country, and those of us who are concerned about these excessive punishments of whistleblowers, the punishment of people who would release information, and yet we see criminals, well-connected thieves, and, of course, the government officials who produce this war on terror, who produce this shock and awe campaign, who conducted America's business in black ops in secret prisons, walking away scot-free. Thank you for your concern, and keep the whistleblowers in your heart and do what you can to help them. We all need the whistleblowers. Thank you very much. This is Richard Spisak, News Director of Progressive News Network. Thank you. I want to bring you some information on the actual trial and what he's being charged with. This comes from, it's called the Article 32 hearing. A panel of experts ruled in April of 2011 that Manning was fit to stand trial. One of the excuses they used for mistreating him so badly was that they threatened that he was a threat to himself. Now, of course, the fact that they kept him in a small metal box, forced him to give up his clothes, kept a light bulb on all night long. Of course, they did that, you know, because they were concerned about his mental state. I'm sure of that. The Article 32 hearing, presided over by Colonel Paul Almanza, was convened on December 16, 2011 at Fort Meade, Maryland, to determine whether to proceed to court-martial. The Army was represented by Captain Ashton Fine, Captain Joe Morrow, and Captain Angel Overgaard. Manning was represented by military attorneys Major Matthew Kemkes and Captain Paul Burchard, and by a civilian attorney, David Combs. The prosecution's evidence. The lead prosecutor, Captain Ashton Fine, argued that Manning had given enemies unfettered access to the material and had displayed an absolute indifference to classified information. He showed the court a video of Adam Gada, an Al-Qaeda spokesman, referencing the leaked material. Of course, it was also published by the New York Times and papers across the planet, so clearly he could only have gotten it that way. The prosecution presented 300,000 pages of documents in evidence, including chat logs and classified material. Nick writes that Manning appeared to have taken few security precautions after his arrest. Detectives searched his basement room in his aunt's house in Potomac, Maryland, and found an SD card. They said it contained Afghan and Iraq war logs along with messages to WikiLeaks. Investigators said he also left trails on his computer of Google and Intel links, and used the wget to download documents. The court heard from two Army investigators, Special Agent David Shaver, head of Digital Forensics and Research Branch of the Army's Computer Crime Investigation Unit, CCIU, and Mark Johnson, a digital forensic contractor from Mantech International, who works for CCIU. They testified that they had found 100,000 State Department cables on a computer that Manning had used between November of 2009 and May of 2010, 400,000 U.S. military reports from Iraq and 91,000 from Afghanistan on the SD card in his aunt's home, 10,000 cables on his personal MacBook Pro, and storage devices that they said had not been passed to WikiLeaks because the file was corrupted. They also said they'd recovered an exchange from May 2010 between Manning and Eric Schmeidel, a Boston mathematician, in which Manning said he was the source of the Baghdad helicopter attack collateral murder video. Now, interesting, you know, of course, being prosecuted for releasing the helicopter attack video, because, of course, the people who actually did the attack in the helicopter, they faced no charges whatsoever. And Johnson said he found a text file called WI Press Text on an external hard drive in Manning's room in Iraq. The file was created November 30th, 2009, and gave contact details in Iceland for WikiLeaks. He said he also recovered 14 to 15 pages of encrypted chats in an unallocated space on Manning's MacBook hard drive between Manning and someone believed to be Julian Assange using the Adium instant messaging client. MacBook login password, Twink1492, was the encryption key. Two of the chat handles, which used the Berlin Chaos Computer Club's domain, ccc.de, had names associated with them, Julian Assange, Nathaniel Frank. Johnson also said he found SSH logs on the MacBook that showed an SFTP connection from an IP address that resolved in Manning's aunt's house to a Swedish IP address with links to WikiLeaks. There's also a text file named README attached to logs apparently written by Manning. Items of historical significance in two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, significant activity. SIG acts between 00001, January 2004, and 2359-31, December 2009. Extracts from CSV documents from Department of Defense and CDNE database. These items have already been sanitized of any source identifying information. You might need to sit on this information for 90 to 180 days to figure out best to send and distribute such a large amount of data to a large audience and protect the source. This is possibly one of the most significant documents of our time, removing the fog of war and revealing the true nature of 21st century asymmetric warfare. Have a good day. Now, obviously, if we take this as truth, this speaks to his raison d'etre. Possibly one of the most significant documents of our time, removing the fog of war and revealing the true nature of 21st century asymmetric warfare. Johnson said there had been two attempts to delete material from the MacBook. The operating system was reinstalled in 2010, or on about January 31. An attempt was made to erase the hard drive doing a zero fill, which involves overwriting material with zeros. The process was started, canceled, then started again, but the material was overwritten only once, which meant that it could be retrieved. Manning's attorney lawyers argued the government had overstated the harm the release of the documents had caused, overcharged Manning to force him to give evidence against Assange. They suggested that other people who had access to Manning's workplace computer, and under cross-examination, Shaver acknowledged that some of the
10,000 cables on Manning's personal computer did not match cables published by WikiLeaks. David Combs, the attorney, asked for dismissal of any charge related to the use of unauthorized software, arguing that Manning's unit had been lawless when it comes to information assurance. The defense also raised the issue of whether Manning's gender identity disorder had affected his judgment. Manning had emailed his master sergeant, Paul Atkins, in April 2010, saying he was suffering from gender confusion. He attached a photograph of himself dressed as a woman. After Manning's arrest, the Army found information about hormone replacement therapy in his room, and his commander, Stephen Lim, learned he'd been calling himself Brianna. His lawyers argued that his superiors had failed to provide adequate counseling and had not taken disciplinary action or revoked his security clearance, and suggested that the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, which was repealed in 2011, made it difficult for Manning to serve in the Army as a gay man. Decision to proceed to court-martial. The hearing resulted in... The hearing resulted in Almanza's recommending that Manning be referred to a general court-martial, and on February 3rd, Major General Michael Linnington, commanding general of the Military District of Washington and the court-martial convening authority, ordered him to stand trial on 22 charges, including aiding the enemy. He was arraigned on February 23rd and declined to enter a plea. January 2012. After the hearing, in January 2012, Combs filed a request to depose six witnesses whose names were redacted in the application and who are believed to be involved in classifying the leaked videos. Combs argued that the videos were not classified at the time they were obtained by WikiLeaks. April 2012, Article 39 hearing. An Article 39 hearing was convened on April 24, 2012, in which the judge, Colonel Denise Lynn, denied a defense motion to dismiss the charge of aiding the enemy and ruled that the government must be able to show that Manning knew the enemy would be able to access information on the WikiLeaks site. She ordered the CIA, FBI, DIA, State Department, and Department of Justice to release documents showing their assessment of whether the leaked material had damaged the national interests of the United States. Lynn said she would decide after reading the documents whether to make them available to Manning's attorneys. She also ordered forensic imaging of five computers removed from Manning's workstation that had not been wiped clean. At the start of the hearing, Manning replaced his two military attorneys, Major Matthew Kemkes and Captain Paul Burchard, with Captain Joshua Tooman. The next 39 hearing is set for June 6 to 8th, and the trial set for late September. May 2012, petition to the Army Court of Criminal Appeals. Center for Constitutional Rights filed a petition in May 2012 asking the Army's Court of Criminal Appeals to order press and public access to motions, papers, orders, and transcripts. Petitioners included Julian Assange, Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, Chase Madar, author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, and the Glenn Greenwald of Salon. September 2012, motion to dismiss. On September 19, 2012, Manning's attorneys filed a motion to dismiss all charges with prejudice, arguing that Manning has been unable to obtain a speedy trial. The motion claims that the 845 days he had spent as of September 2012 is much longer than periods that the Court of Appeals have found to be facially unreasonable. The U.S. military requires a trial within 120 days. Obviously, eight times that doesn't quite meet the test. Okay, now that we've covered some of that material, let's go on to some more contemporary material. And bear in mind, when someone undertakes the great and terrible risk of putting themselves at risk so that you can hear the real information, when a whistleblower decides to risk life and prison and more so that you will know the truth, they are not acting in a way that furthers their career, their life, or in any way enhances them. Instead, they're putting themselves at risk so that the truth, which is being concealed, can be known. This is from a statement
Julian Manning, Assange urged the U.S. to release Bradley Manning. This was back from Sunday, the 19th of August, 2012. Julian Assange has challenged the U.S. to end its witch hunt of WikiLeaks and release the army private accused of feeding a trove of classified information to the whistleblowing website. In a defiant message delivered from the balcony of the Ecuadorian embassy in London, Assange, whose Swedish prosecutors want extradited over claims of sexual assault, said that America must dissolve its investigation into his organization. Urging President Barack Obama to do the right thing, he also called for the immediate release of Bradley Manning, the young soldier accused of being behind the biggest leak of state secrets in U.S. history. The 24-year-old is currently being detained at an army base, awaiting military trial. He's been indicted on 22 counts relating to the leaks, including charges of aiding the enemy. The crime carries a maximum penalty of death, although prosecutors have indicated they will not seek the ultimate punishment. In his address on Sunday, Assange noted that Manning has now spent more than 800 days behind bars without trial. For a large chunk of that time, Manning was kept in conditions that the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Juan Mendez, has described as cruel and inhuman. The young soldier's lawyers are currently seeking to have the charges against Manning dismissed, citing the U.S. Army's flagrant violation of his right not to be punished prior to trial. His civilian attorney, David Coombs, has lodged legal documents detailing his treatment at the Quantico Marine Base in Virginia, where Manning was being kept before being transferred to a softer prison, whatever the hell that is, under huge pressure from human rights activists. The so-called Article 13 motion revealed that for months after his arrest in May 2010, the soldier was kept in a 6-foot by 8-foot cell for 23 or 24 hours a day. In addition, when not sleeping, the suspect was banned from lying down or even using a wall to support him. It's also claimed that Manning was punished through degradation and humiliation, notably by forcing him to stand outside his cell naked during morning inspection. This, his attorney claims, was retaliatory punishment for speaking out over his treatment. It's been suggested that the harsh treatment was used to intimidate Manning into a plea deal with the U.S. prosecutors under which he would testify against Assange at a future date. At a lengthy pretrial hearing in December, Coombs said, if the Department of Justice got their way, they would get a plea in this case and get my client named as one of the witnesses to go after Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. In Sunday's statement, Assange made an impassioned appeal for Manning to be freed. Bradley Manning must be released. If Bradley Manning did as he is accused, he is a hero, an example to all of us, and one of the world's foremost political prisoners. The U.S. must also renounce its witch hunt against WikiLeaks, Assange demanded from his Ecuadorian embassy location. It's thought that the grand jury in Virginia has been investigating the Australian citizen with a view toward conducting a criminal prosecution based on FBI evidence against him. Assange called on President Obama to dissolve that federal probe on Saturday, adding, the U.S. must vow that it will not seek to prosecute our staff or our supporters. He continued, the U.S. must pledge before the world that it will not prosecute journalists for shining a light on the secret crimes of the powerful. As such, there must be no foolish talk about seeking to put on its trial organizations such as WikiLeaks, the New York Times, along with the Guardian, or newspapers that published documents put out by the whistleblowing website. Okay, this is a clip from Democracy Now! On the Manning case.
Life in prison, convicted of the most serious of 22 counts against him. His trial is expected to begin in February. Meanwhile, the founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, remained holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he sought refuge nearly 6 months ago to avoid being extradited to Sweden to be questioned over sexual assault claims. Earlier this week, Assange vowed WikiLeaks would persevere despite attacks against it. On Tuesday, the European Commission announced that the credit card company Visa did not break the European Union's antitrust rules by blocking donations to WikiLeaks. Shortly after the ruling, Assange addressed reporters in Brussels via video stream from inside the Ecuadorian embassy.
The strength of popular and private support means that we continue. There is no danger that WikiLeaks will cease to exist as an organization. Rather, its natural and rightful growth has been compromised, and that is wrong and must change. It would set a very bad precedent. It is not only wrong for WikiLeaks, it sets an extremely bad precedent for all other European organizations and all media organizations worldwide, that monopolies can simply exercise financial death penalties over organizations and companies as a result of political controversy.
That was Julian Assange speaking on Tuesday.
Thank you, Amy. There is issues about his treatment. There are issues about the charges. There's issues about what it actually means when they say aiding the enemy. And, of course, the other interesting aspect of these matters is the fact that many of these things are being invoked under the heading of these grand juries, secret grand juries. Here is a transcript of the investigation and questioning of David House, who is regarded as a personal friend of Mr. Manning's. And I think that this is very illustrative of some of the things that happen in this situation. These are transcripts of David House's interview during that grand jury. This is a record of proceedings. It's recorded by David House, the grand jury in Alexandria, Virginia, 15 June 2011, 4:10 to 5 p.m. Inside the grand jury, DOJ counterespionage section attorney Patrick Murphy, DOJ counterespionage section attorney Deborah Curtis, Eastern District of Virginia, AUSA Bob Weishering, Eastern District Court of Virginia, AUSA Tracy McCormick, Eastern District of Virginia, AUSA Karen Dunn, an unspecified number of grand jurors, a court stenographer, David House. Directly outside the grand jury, Mike Condon, FBI agent from Washington, D.C. field office, James Farmer, chief of anti-terrorism and national security at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Mass, and Peter Krupp, David House's attorney. The record begins at 4:10. David House is sworn in and informed of his rights. Patrick Murphy, would you please state your full name for the record? David House. My name is David House. PM. Did you meet Bradley Manning in January 2010? David House says, on advice of counsel, I invoke my right to remain silent under the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. I am concerned that this grand jury is seeking information designed to infringe or chill my associational privilege and my associational privacy and that of others guaranteed by the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and is using information obtained without a search warrant in violation of the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. I define the preceding statement as invoke, and when I say invoke in the future, I am referring to this statement. Let me read you that again. On advice of counsel, I invoke my right to remain silent under the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. I am concerned that this grand jury is seeking information designed to infringe or chill my associational privacy and that of others, guaranteed by the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And it's using information obtained without a search warrant in violation of the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution. I define the preceding statement as invoke, so when I say invoke in the future, I'm referring to that statement. Deborah Curtis, Exhibit 1A. Mr. House, please direct your attention to the screen behind you, Exhibit 1A. DC, I can't make it bigger. PM, try here, remove that bar on the side. DC, that didn't work. DH, do you guys need help? That's David House. DC, we just need to make it bigger. Can everyone see this okay? PM, okay, we're going to continue. A still image from the Frontline PBS special is displayed on the screen. Four figures are standing in front of the Builds logo. One figure has her back turned. PM, Mr. House, can you identify the man on the right? David House, I invoke. PM, okay, can you identify the person with the bright colored hair standing there? DH, I invoke. PM, are we to believe that identifying that individual would somehow incriminate you? David House, on the advice of counsel, I invoke my right to remain silent under the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. I am concerned that this grand jury is seeking information designed to infringe or chill my associational privacy and that of others guaranteed by the First Amendment to the Constitution, and that it is using information obtained without a search warrant in violation of the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. PM. Okay, can you identify the man on the left? PM. I would like to observe for the record that Mr. House is taking notes. Mr. House. As to the previous question, I invoke. PM. Why are you taking notes? David House. Invoke. Bob Wischerling. I'd like to recommend at this point that we take a break and talk to your counsel. AUSAs and the House leave the grand jury. Peter Krupp, House's attorney, asserts David's right to invoke. AUSAs and the House return to the grand jury. PM, what is your birth date? David House, March 14th, 1987. PM, where do you live? David House, can you restate the question? PM, what is your address? DH, I invoke. PM, what is your current occupation? DH, I invoke. PM, were you a senior in computer science at Boston University in January of 2010? DH, I invoke. PM, isn't it true you told PBS Frontline that you were a senior at Boston University in January 2010? David House, I invoke. PM, do you know what a hackerspace is? David House, I invoke. PM, do you know what BILDS is, the acronym? DH, I invoke. Bob Wischerling, Mr. House, I notice you're taking notes. Attempting to create your own transcript is a violation of Rule 6E of this grand jury. We have brought this to the attention of your counsel, and although he feels differently on the matter, we assert that you must stop taking notes at this time. DH, let me consult with my attorney. House leaves the grand jury room and returns 1 minute later. DH, my attorney asks that you refer all questions about notes to him. BW, let's continue. PM, Mr. House, are you involved with the Bradley Manning Support Network? DH, I invoke. Do you respond in the affirmative when asked by the FBI if you'd heard of or known WikiLeaks associate Jacob Applebaum? PM, and I would like to state for the record that Mr. House is not answering the question and is instead taking notes. DH, I invoke. PM, do you intend to answer any of my questions aside from your date of birth and your name? David House, I invoke. Is that because of the phalanx of attorneys present here today? Court stenographer, I'm sorry, the what of attorneys? PM, phalanx of attorneys. DH, as to the phalanx of attorneys, I evoke. PM, at this time I will let Deborah Curtis ask a few questions. Mr. House, have you ever been to the Oxford Spa restaurant in Cambridge, Mass? David House, allow me to consult with my attorney. House leaves the grand jury and returns 1 minute later. As to the previous question, I invoke. Ms. Curtis, you admitted to federal agents in Boston that you had met Bradley Manning in January 2010. Is that correct? David House, I invoke. Ms. Curtis, isn't it true that you spent the night of January 27, 2010 with Daniel Clark and Bradley Manning? Mr. House, can you repeat the question? Isn't it true that you spent the night of January 27, 2010 with Daniel Clark and Bradley Manning? David House, one more time. Ms. Curtis, isn't it true that you spent the night of January 27, 2010 with Daniel Clark and Bradley Manning? PM, he's writing it down. Ms. Curtis, are you getting this? Are you writing this all down? DH, was the last question a question to be answered? Yes. I invoke. And the question before? I also invoke. Where did Danny Clark have breakfast on the morning of January 28, 2010? DH, allow me to consult with my attorney. House leaves the grand jury and returns 1 minute later. As to the previous question, I invoke. Do you intend to answer any questions about Daniel Clark? Invoke. Do you intend to answer any questions about Bradley Manning? He's writing. Could you please repeat the question? Do you intend to answer any question about Jacob Applebaum? I invoke. At this time, we'd like to stop the proceedings. You're free to leave. Record of proceedings as recorded by David House, Grand Jury, Alexandria, Virginia, 15 June 2011, 4:10 p.m. to 5 p.m. That, ladies and gentlemen, was the interview by Mr. House. Another piece I want to read to you, which I think you'll find interesting, is this from the Bradley Manning Support Network. And if you're concerned about whistleblowers, you should know that Daniel Ellsberg regards Manning as a hero and has totally given his support to Manning. And there's a petition that you can get access to on the Bradley Manning Support Network site. Just do a search for Bradley Manning Support Network. And there's a petition there by Daniel Ellsberg. Let me read a little bit to you from that. Signed a petition to free Bradley Manning, the brave young whistleblower who exposed war crimes and has been unlawfully punished. Hold on 1 second. Give me 1 second. Let's see here. I'm going to try to add in another guest. Let's see, I've got Mr. Tom Beardshaw. Tom, are you there?
Hi, you're right.
Good, good. And yourself?
Yeah, very well, thanks. And you're all set, are you? What time are you starting?
Well, we're actually on the air right now.
Oh, cool. Okay.
ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Tom Beardshaw, who is a digital producer and a very talented multimedia developer, who worked on a project where it was a, I'm going to call it a multimedia play. Maybe you should describe the Bradley Manning interactive multimedia piece that you produced or were involved in the production of.
Sure. Well, National Theatre Wales, which is a fairly new and quite innovative company producing theatre in Wales, decided to create a play called The Radicalization of Bradley Manning. The reason behind that was that Bradley is part Welsh, and part of his early life was after his parents divorced, he came and lived in a town called Haverford West in the very west edge of Wales. Now, we had been working with National Theatre Wales for a while on quite a few digital initiatives. Some people may have heard of The Passion with Michael Sheen. We did an online dimension to that show, and we decided to build in a kind of multi-platform internet based component to that show from the very start. I mean, it was, you know, it's the site of Bradley Manning's story in many ways, and so what we did was we embedded CCTV cameras into the set, and we built a website which had a CCTV video window, and underneath that there was a kind of live chat so the audience could interact with each other. And we had another part of that page carried links that were related to what you were seeing at that time. So this wasn't archived, it was live only. So it was kind of paying homage to the theatre tradition of live performance. And as you were watching, let's say you were watching a scene with Bradley Manning speaking to his father, then there were links to interviews with his dad, and when he was on stage leaking information, there were stories that you could link to which allowed you to explore those leaks. It was essentially a way of creating an online experience of that play that gave the audience a way to explore Bradley's story for themselves.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, it's a real innovative way of presenting a very complex story. And
yeah,
providing research, you know, access to research materials, supported materials, as well as seeing the live interactive live theater element of it.
That's really a revolutionary use of media, I think.
Yeah, well, The Guardian said something similar this week. There was a writer who was exploring the future of the use of digital in theatre, and they really focused on the use of networks. And we managed to get out to a few of the key networks like WikiLeaks and Anonymous. They tweeted links to the show when it was happening. We had about 10,000 people tune in from 72 countries, which was, well, I think for the theatre company, that was fairly revolutionary. There were 100 seats in the theatre space itself, and we wanted to create not a replication of the theatre experience, but a native web experience building on that play.
Oh, that's such a neat idea. I mean, I happen to be a web teacher in one of my lives, and you know, I help people understand how to use the medium, you know, as should we say, nascent early prototype web designers. But when I heard this concept, where you've got a live theater element, you've got a video element, you've got the research links to material, that's absolutely the ideal perfect use of the medium.
Yeah, sure. Well, the theatre play was, in some sense, it was serving the telling of the story of Bradley Manning, and we didn't want the online aspect of that to serve the play. It was there to serve Bradley's story and to get it out as far and as wide as we possibly could.
Oh, that's amazing. I wonder, could you talk to me about how this project evolved? At what point were you brought in? Was it started at the beginning as a multimedia piece, or did it evolve in that direction?
Yeah, well, that was fairly interesting, because I've been involved in quite a few theatre productions, and more often than not, they give you a ring a few weeks before the show and say, hey, can you come and do something? But we'd been talking to the creative director of National Theatre Wales for a while and saying that you really need to get us in at the ground floor and to conceptualise this work as a multi-platform productions, because there are going to be implications for how the story is told, for what the set designer needs to do, sound technicians, lighting technicians. There will be implications for all of them. And I think what happened was the writer, Tim Price, read an article about Bradley's Welsh roots, and he was due to have a meeting with the National Theatre of Wales about another concept he had, and he just switched his mind and talked to them about, you know, has anyone given you the idea of doing a play about Bradley Manning? Because it's got to be done. And the next day, because it was right at the time of the season launch, and the next day there was an article in The Guardian saying National Theatre of Wales doing a play about Bradley Manning, and he, I don't think he'd written a word by then. I think he was like, oh, okay, this is happening, I better get writing. So I then met with John about a week later and said, look, I really would love to be involved in this. And it was, you know, it was about 9 months later. So it was a long lead time, which gave us an opportunity to really think about the kind of interactions we were going to deliver on the web.
Oh, my gosh.
And
imagine a long lead time to develop.
I know. Extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah. So we really got a chance to think.
You died onto Wales or something?
Yeah. Found the bread of heaven, absolutely. so we had an ample opportunity to really think about it and to talk to the other designers and the actors. We were in at the very first sort of reading of the script and thinking about the implications of what story was being told, and that gave us a real chance to develop a clear vision of what we wanted to do.
Let me ask you a question. I mean, I can visual. You know, I'm an interactive digital designer myself, so I can imagine some of the things that might have been involved. I mean, did you do things like he clicks on the screen to begin a download, and there, visible either to the live audience or to the web experiencing audience, a list of files scrolling down one of the subsections of the screen?
We didn't do that online. We just had three major elements, because we didn't want to distract people too far away from the video, but we wanted to give them a chance to springboard into archived material on the web, you know, things that were sitting on Wired or you know, various news sites around the world. So we were just creating a portal for that journey. But in the play, we had about 30 monitors lit up around the set, and there was a scene where Bradley does the download, and everyone's crowded. The other five cast members were crowded around him. And then there's a big dance number with a Lady Gaga track.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah.
That's nice.
And they threw a load of papers up into the air, and it comes down as confetti. I mean, it's theatre, so, you know, it's about creating entertainment as well as telling a serious story.
Sure. Well, it's such a pleasure to be able to laugh for just a moment about this very, very serious topic. Let me ask you this. The live component of this in the theater, when the interaction with what we mean, say, the connection to WikiLeaks happened, was that done in a silhouette? Was there some representative of WikiLeaks there on the stage or on a screen somewhere?
Well, no, we avoided that completely because it was about a year ago, and at the time, Bradley hadn't made any kind of response. I mean, clearly now he's prepared to acknowledge that he is responsible for that leak, but we had a meeting with some very high-powered lawyers in London.
I would guess.
Yes. And, you know, there we were hugely exposed to all sorts of potential damaging legal implications. We were wondering if there was any scope for the American authorities to seek to arrest our director and whether that would be a good thing or a bad thing. I think that debate's still open. But
getting of all publicity is good publicity.
Well, yeah, potentially. I don't think he'd have been pleased, so we tried to avoid it. What happened on stage was it was a great piece of work because Tim was really empathizing with Bradley's Welsh upbringing in many ways. And we were exploring the themes around his radicalization. So it wasn't a story that started with him joining the army. It was a story that opened in a school in Haverford West where he attended. And we actually opened that play in the school hall in that school, Tosca Millwood School in Haverford West. And we'd spent a couple of weeks there rehearsing that and met some of the staff who knew Bradley when he was there. There were lots of people coming in and out who'd met him and who were aware of what was going on.
Could you explain, many of my audience, while they know some things about the UK, they may not know too much about Wales, and certainly the concept of Welsh radicalism is probably, let me jokingly say, foreign to them. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'll start from the beginning. Wales is a country which is a part of the UK. So the United Kingdom consists at the moment of England, which you've probably heard of, Scotland, which I'm sure you have as well.
Many Wales, Americans have. Don't let them tell you otherwise.
Yeah, Wales and Northern Ireland. So Wales is to the left of England on the map. It's the little kind of bumpy bit on the left-hand side. And we've got a curious history. I mean, as a nation, it's only really come into being in the last 10 years with the establishment of a Welsh Parliament. But it has a very separate identity in many parts to England, although it was invaded and there are lots of Welsh English speakers and English kind of immigrants. I myself, I'm an Englishman who came to Wales 20 years ago, really. So
a newcomer.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, if you go up to the north of Wales, then you'll find that there's a lot of communities who speak the Welsh language, Cymraeg, which is a different language. And there's a lot of politics around that. And Wales is a bilingual country. And it was essentially kind of colonized by England in the south in the last 500 years. But there's been a history of radicalism within Wales, which some of your listeners may be aware of the sort of consequences. So an Eirin Bevin, who founded the National Health Service in the UK, he came from the South Wales Valleys, and I think, I'm not sure of my history, Welsh people will correct me, but there was a kind of miners' community-funded health service in either Treorchy or Tonopandy, which inspired him to create this nationalised health service, which is one of the things that British people are most proud of, I think, these days. But if we go back to the early industrialization in the sort of 1800s, 1700s, Wales was a country which was producing a lot of iron, steel, and later coal. Wales was fueling the Industrial Revolution, essentially, producing the best coal in the world and exporting it all the way around the world. So I'm sure that many of your trains in the early days, as the train network was built, were fueled by Welsh coal. In the early 1800s, there was a series of protests by peasants in West Wales who were protesting against toll booths. And there was a very famous protest called the Rebecca Riots, where all of the peasants dressed up in women's clothing and started to attack the toll booths. A few years later, there was a famous uprising in a town called Merthyr Tydfil, where the first raising of the red flag in Europe occurred, and they took over the town, demanded workers' rights. Some of the first unions were created there. It has a history of radicalism. So in the play opens up it opened up literally in Tasker Millwood School in Haverford West, where Bradley attended, in the school hall. And the first scene is a classroom in the school. And he's 14 years old, and he must have been about 11 or 12. And he had just joined the class. So it's full of lots of Welsh school children, and Bradley joins them as this American. And I should point out that there were six actors. They were all about the same age as Bradley. It was a very young cast, and they did an amazing job considering how demanding it was. And they were playing, there was probably, maybe 30, 40 characters in the play. So they were all switching roles all the way through. And every single one of those cast members at some point played Bradley. So there were four guys and two girls, and all of them played Bradley Manning at one point in his story. And in this classroom, there was a history teacher who was teaching about this radical history. And Bradley was interacting with that and the other kids, and they were learning about the way the Welsh had sort of pioneered the demand for workers' rights and the desire for justice and equality. And then it sort of intercut with another story in Bradley's life, which was from when he landed back in the UK, in the US, having left Wales. And he goes through that journey of being unable to find a job and his dad getting frustrated and eventually joining the US in order to get into university. That's why he did it. I mean, he joined the military in the United States so that he could get into a good university to get a degree in computer science. And then it goes into his life in the military. There's lots of accounts of bullying that he experienced, his experiences in Iraq, his discovery of materials which essentially exposed war crimes by the US military, and his eventual decision, just as he was about to be demoted and returned to the US, to download that material and to pass it on. So it was a play that took us from Bradley as he was just becoming a teenager through the next 10 years.
Oh, that's so interesting. You know, to tie the development of that moral sense to the historic growth of worker rights and human rights in Wales is the teaching of the kind of, should we say, as you described it, the birth of the union movement, or the birth of the workers' rights movement. Is that taught typically in Welsh schools, or was that unique to that particular school he was attending?
I didn't go to a Welsh school, so that's a question I probably can't answer. I'm sure some other people in Wales can, but certainly the Rebecca Riots, the Merthyr Risings, are a fundamental part of Welsh history in the last couple of hundred years. And I mean, I know of some people who complained quite loudly that Welsh history isn't properly taught in Welsh schools. It's a British history that's spoken of, which is, you know, kings and queens and the Second World War, the Industrial Revolution.
You know, the important people that count.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's tension in the curriculum between Welsh identity in history and British identity in history. Now education is devolved to Welsh government, so that may or may not change, but it's certainly been defined by the British government prior to that.
You know, you mentioned the author was interested or intrigued by the idea of a multimedia production, and you know, you mentioned that it was kind of auspicious the way it came about initially. So as when he was writing it, was he trying to include these multimedia elements, or just jotting some notes down that it might be nice to do this, or was that grafted on at the second draft or the third draft stage?
We had a conversation, and he knew that there would be some form of multimedia, but we hadn't defined it. When he sort of locked himself away over the summer of 2010 to write the piece, I think as scripts came in, I started feeding back to the director about that. It was more, as that script was developed, I think it was brokered more by the director having an overall vision of the piece than directly between me and the writer. I mean, Tim's a good friend, but I think it was John McGrath, the director, who needed to hold the whole together. And there were possibly more consequences for the set designer, lighting designers, sound people, so that we had the right feeds from the right places. And really very late in the day, as we were just pulling the play together, the actors started to realize the consequences. You know, don't stand there, our camera can't see you, stand over there. We probably could have done with more time, but as you may know, theatre has a deadline.
There's never enough time.
No, and it is what it is on the day that the curtains open on the show. I mean, you get as far as you can, and you hope that's an experience that moves the audience.
Was it a one-day performance?
No, we had about 10 or 12, maybe 15 performances in three different locations.
Oh, how nice.
And we live-streamed all of them onto the web. Yeah, what we didn't do is archive it. So, you know, if you missed it, you missed it. We didn't save it to YouTube or any place where you can see it now. I think I've got a couple of files on my hard drive with video, but it wasn't a pure video experience. I think with the quality of the video we were able to produce with CCTV cameras, it wouldn't have been a particularly compelling experience. And on the web, everyone's got a Google bar and a back button. It would have been easy to leave that. But it was by being connected to others who were also watching and to the story as it existed on the wider web that we were trying to create something specifically for the web that would be compelling.
Well, I think that the use of the CCTV cameras also added to that mil-spec, industrial, grainy, institutionalized look and feel, too. I mean, it would have been a different experience if you'd gone HD and wall-to-wall and all that. That would.
Yeah, we were definitely playing with that aesthetic and that idea of voyeurism and so the CCTV camera as a tool of control as well. We were certainly playing with those sort of feelings and themes in it, absolutely.
Well, especially since the UK is known as very much having that kind of, what's a good way of putting it? Well, just spy cams everywhere.
Yeah, I think we're now the most monitored country in Europe. I'm not sure about the world. Somebody will correct me. But our director actually wrote a book about surveillance several years ago, so it was a particular interest to him. And you know, he was musing on the question of what happens to your life when almost everything is under surveillance. Is your life affected by that notion of performance?
Well, you're the most surveilled, and we're the most heavily armed.
Yeah.
Where is civilization headed, right?
Well, I think I'd rather be here, to be honest.
Well, Sarah, ex-governor Palin, can see Russia from there, at least you can't be hit by the backfire from over here.
Yeah, quite. Yeah. No, I mean, It's an interesting issue. It's certainly a measure of control. I think I wonder about guns in America feel like a measure of a lack of control.
Well, I'm sure there's a variety of psychological analyses it could be submitted to.
It certainly looks like a very scary place to be for my behavior.
Well, I can tell you right now, I am not armed at all.
Oh, that's a relief.
Except for the two that come out of my shoulder.
Okay.
Let me ask you this. You mentioned the aspect of bullying and how critical that is. Many of us have heard that your public schools over there, which are in fact what we would call private schools, are sort of hotbeds of a bullying culture. And of course, we are no slouches when it comes to that either. I was wondering, how was that incorporated into the play, especially if you could describe that from the beginning, from the school year side?
Well, when Bradley entered the classroom in Haverford West, I mean, firstly, he was an outsider. He was an American. Secondly, he was presumably quite small. I mean, he's a small man as it is. And he was a bit of a geek. He had his head in the computer. And there's a lot of evidence we kind of built together a picture of his life at that time, that he was seen as somebody with his head in his computer, who was incredibly talented in that area, but he might not have felt so socially comfortable. And there is a hint that there was bullying in that. The writer certainly played on that as a theme in the whole play overall. I experienced my own dose of bullying as a kid, and I think one of the things that one of the effects it had on me was to help me to identify with the weak. And that may have been part of Bradley's experience. I mean, this play as a whole was a political fantasy. I mean, Bradley wasn't, he's unable to speak to this play, and he's unable to voice his own experience. So it was from the imagination of the writer. We were very clear about that. But also, there's quite a lot of experience of evidence, I think, that he experienced bullying in the military. He was bullied. In the play, he was bullied in the induction process when he joined the army. He was quite isolated when he was in Iraq, and he was seen as a bit of an oddball. I'm sure that I know from evidence I've seen that there is quite a lot of bullying in the United States military. There's a lot of machismo, and he's not the most macho man I've come across. So more of an intellectual, quiet, small guy. He seems like an obvious target for that kind of attention, and that was certainly played out. There's a scene where he was visiting his boyfriend in Boston, where he was made up to be bruised all over his body, and that was quite poignant, and that was just before he returned to Iraq for the last time. So I think that's probably the last time he's spoken to anyone outside the military, except his lawyer. Well, he's military too. So it was certainly a prominent theme, and I think we left it up to the audience to interpret that. I mean, my personal interpretation of that kind of experience is that it can turn you, either way. You can often become a bully yourself, or you can be someone with a deep sense of compassion for the weak and the vulnerable. It depends how you take it.
I think you make an important tie there, that someone who's experienced that kind of brutality would see the treatment of citizens of Iraq who are being mistreated, who are clearly being brutalized, and have some sympathy there.
Sure.
And,
yeah.
And clearly, take the helicopter video. Did you include that helicopter video?
Oh yeah. When the audience was walking into the space we used, it was the soundtrack of that was blaring out. It was incredibly loud, and we designed a walk through the school into the school hall, which was a soundscape, which contained snippets from that video soundtrack, and it appeared on, as I said, we had sort of 30 odd screens attached to various parts of the set, and it was displayed there. So yeah, that was very much a part of it and a part of the theme. And I can imagine seeing that and watching the children being shot at must have freaked him out. I mean, I often, you know, I mean, my question is probably similar to many of your listeners. You know, if you have a country that's promoting truth, justice, and freedom amongst the population, and then you provide a million plus people with access to a network where you're clearly violating those principles, is it any surprise that that's going to get out into wider public attention? I mean, it's obviously a crime, and the US government seems to be treating Bradley as the criminal here. I don't know what's happened. I don't think anything's happened to the guys who committed those crimes.
Nothing.
His trial is a massive diversion from their criminal acts.
Well, I don't know how much you've heard of the American media recently, but there's been a flood of books on just how brutal Vietnam was.
Yeah.
And what was really happening there. So here we've got people 30 years on, plus, telling the truth, finally, about the, I can't even be ironic about it, about the terrible, terrible, terrible things that were done. And you can't even say to, quote, liberate the people of Vietnam, because that's not what it was about. It was a search and destroy mission. And one of the books that was just came out and is being well received is one, Kill Anything That Moved.
Sure.
And you can imagine now where they're using supportive psychotropic drugs to keep troops on, you know, tour after tour after tour on 24 and 36 hour missions, that the human judgment is probably absolutely absent from the scene.
Sure.
Critical stuff. To be serious for a second, you all must have entered into this, and you mentioned there were attorneys involved. You must have went into this very open-eyed, that you had to be careful what you said, what you portrayed. Could you talk a little bit about that discussion?
Yeah, we had a meeting with some top and fairly expensive lawyers in London before the show, before we really started getting into the production cycle. And for one, we asked questions that they had never come across before. A lot of it was about the liability of the people involved. Could the American authorities seek to take action on us, and if so, for what? We had to be very clear in all our marketing to say this is a fiction created with the imagination of the author, loosely related to some facts, but the timeline and what had happened had been altered for dramatic purposes. I mean, we had to be very clear about that and avoid any sense that this was a biography or a sort of factual documentary. Nevertheless, you know, we took risks with it. We had several scenes where Bradley's character or the person who was playing Bradley at the time was in incarceration. I mean, the opening of the play, I remember, was very dramatic. The audience came into this dark hall, sat around the edge, and the set was a tower at each corner, and at the bottom it was surrounded by computer monitors. At the top it was covered in CCTV cameras, one of which was working and the others were kind of models. And there was a table in the center of the stage with a cloth, with a big tarpaulin over it. And everyone just ignored it as they walked in. They, you know, it didn't mean anything to them. And then there was a loud bang, and a spotlight fell on the table. And one of the actors in full U.S. military uniform pulled the tarpaulin away to reveal Bradley Manning naked and sort of shivering under that on top of the table. And it was incredibly dramatic. And there were, on the last show that we performed at Haverford West in Bradley's old school, his mother was in the audience. And there were several scenes where he was being kind of abused verbally by the US military, the Marines who were looking after him. Well, I say looking after him, they were in charge of him at Quantico, where he was being verbally abused and tormented by questions every few minutes. That had a hell of an impact on the cast and crew. We were quite shaken after that because Bradley's mum walked out very sheepishly, I think, and met very briefly with the cast afterwards, and then went with her partner back to her house. And we just wondered, you know, gosh, did we go too far, or you know, what effect has that had on her? We didn't know. She looked shaken though, but we wanted to avoid pulling the punches that we didn't have to, and we took some risks with what we tried to portray. We did try to portray his early experience of incarceration, where he was very badly mistreated by the military.
Did you have him questioned and standing at attention with naked?
He had a pair of boxers on. I mean, they were flesh coloured, but you know, he wasn't completely naked. That one might have been too much, but absolutely. He was surrounded by Marines telling him to, turn to the left, turn to the right, say I, not yes, and barking instructions at him. There were lots of interactions with the kind of commandant of the unit, where he was complaining about his treatment and just being told that the guy wasn't listening. I think that head of that unit eventually lost his job.
Yeah, he did. He did later admit that there was some mistreatment involved.
Sure.
Misjudgment, I think, certainly nothing, you know, criminal or anything, because of course we don't really have civil rights. Did you address the fact that the UN human rights rapporteur was turned away?
We didn't actually. We were focused on Bradley's experience more than the unfolding story around him, and we didn't even really cover the Adrian Lamo chats. We were telling the core of a story, and we had about an hour and a half to do it. So we were focused on Bradley's experience, and you know, a central question we were asking was, you know, who radicalized Bradley? I mean, how did he get radicalized? So what led to that decision to do that leak? And, you know, half of the play was him in school in Haverford West, interacting with other kids. We had a scene where there was an interaction where one of the other kids was the sort of bully's victim in the classroom. And he was... he was a computer geek as well, and there was interaction between him and Bradley where Bradley was essentially on his side. He made a decision to be on this kid's side and to try and get involved in various computer hackery with him. Well, one of the lovely things we found was, I mean, I went to, when I was doing my research, I went to the Internet Archive, and I looked up the website that Bradley built when he was in Wales years ago. You know, we're talking 10 years ago. He was a sort of 13, 14-year-old. And I'm just looking for the link now. Hang on. No. Just looking on my computer to see if I can find it. There was a website that he built, which was, the subtitle was... Pembrokeshire's finest social network, which was quite interesting, really. I mean, there was, this is 2003. He started a website called angeldyne.com. So angeldyne.com. If you go to the Wayback Machine, the Internet Archive, then you can find archived versions of that website from 2003, 4, 5, where I think he was running it. And so when there was this interaction with the other computer geek who was being bullied in the classroom,
the link popped up to that internet archive. And one of the things that sort of chilled me to the bones when I saw it was that there was an article by Bradley Manning. I've just got it here. I mean, I don't know how I can get a link to you. There was an article about the suicide of Dr. David Kelly. You may remember, may or not know about him in the US, but he was a government weapons inspector working for the UN. And he basically, I mean, there was a whole load of controversies about David Kelly's involvement. I mean, he was trying to be honest about the weapons that Iraq had. So this
right.
is just before the war. And he, while he was in the UK, he was quizzed by, that's right, I'm just looking at the story now. So, you know, there was a sense that that he was leaking information to the press. Dr. David Kelly was, there was an internal investigation within the government to find out who had been talking to the press about the fact that the UK government's dossier on Iraq weapons had been sexed up. That was the phrase, sexed up by the politicians to make it look like Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. I mean, there were headlines on BBC News and various other sources saying Iraq is sort of 40 minutes away. It's got a 40-minute capability of being able to send rockets to the UK, and it was an attempt to build up fear about Iraq. Now, David Kelly was a fairly honest broker in all this, and the investigation found out that he had leaked that information. Now, I might not be entirely accurate here, but what happened was that he then committed suicide. Right. So now a lot of people, and there's been various investigations, and he was found dead in a park next to a hedge. And I remember the day when his body was discovered, and on the breaking news, sources like the BBC said immediately it looks like a suicide, which I thought was quite suspicious. And there was no sign of foul play, to which I thought, well, you know, what do we pay Secret Service for? I mean, if they leave signs of foul play, they're not very good, are they? And there's, you know, that, so there's this whole story about Dr. Kelly, a very famous whistleblower who died in 2003. And on the website that Bradley Manning created for West Wales, where he lived, there is an article about that issue, about Dr. David Kelly and the investigation into that whole scenario, signed by Bradley Manning, dated 29th of January 2004. So when you've got the character of Bradley and the other kid who was bullied in the school working together on a computer program, there was a link to that story on the web at the same time. I think that was probably my best find in terms of connecting people to material on the web that tells Bradley's story.
Well, they say that history may not repeat itself, but it rhymes. Certainly,
yeah.
That's an interesting and ironic find that he's thinking about that and looking at someone and considering what might have gone through their minds.
Sure. I've just sent you the link over Skype. I don't know if there's anything you can do that.
No, I just got it. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's that article by Bradley Manning. Yeah. I mean, it was amazing finding that old website where he was one of the people who led the development of it. You know, 2013. How old is he now? 24? He must have been 14 at the time. He was clearly a very talented programmer, and, you know, computers were his playground. And that's what the people who were at school with him or knew him through school told us.
I was also curious, what kind of reaction did your play get in the press?
Well, it got a great few reviews from the UK papers. I mean, John McGrath, the director, is a very talented theatre maker, and Tim Price is one of Wales's most talented writers. So it was well received. It was probably less well received by the very traditional theatre critics, but a lot of people praised it. I mean, we've recently had the Theatre Awards in Wales, and John received the Best Director Award for that play, and there were a couple of other. There was an award for the Best Ensemble, because for the group of six actors who acted it out, and we ourselves got an award for Best Digital Multi-Platform Elements of Theatre. So it's been appreciated as a really innovative piece of theatre. I mean, I think a lot of people thought it was very brave, which it was. It was very brave and risky. I mean, we actually at the time thought that the release, the actual performances were going to coordinate with the beginning of Bradley's trial. I mean, this is April 2012, so, you know, we can see how long we've been waiting for a trial, from the fact that we were worried that the trial would be over by the time our play came out and the story would be out of date. But obviously it's dragged on. But, I mean, if you look on the web, you can find reviews from the Telegraph and various news outlets where it's fairly well lauded. As I said yesterday, well, not yesterday, the day before I think it was, The Guardian released a theatre blog about the use of digital within theatre productions, and it highlighted the radicalisation of Bradley Manning as the best example of that.
Well, I'm not surprised given what you told me about it. Let me ask you this. Being a political writer and essayist myself, a lot of my own pieces are very imbued with my politics. Among the writer, producer, technical producer, multimedia creator that you were, did your politics all align with what we might call some skepticism toward the war on Iraq?
I don't think you'd be wrong in that. I mean, the biggest march in the UK in recent memory was against the war in Iraq before it just started. The UK has a population who is deeply skeptical and is now being proved correct. Wales is one of the more radical islands of the United Kingdom, and I think, I'm sure that certainly with the writer, what I know of his politics and a few other people on the crew, there was a lot of sort of congruence between our thoughts. But the focus of our work here was not to be a part of the campaign. It was not a political campaign.
More about the human side.
Yeah, it was saying, look, this guy's from Wales. He's one of us. He's going through the most incredible experience right now, and he's at the center of a firestorm. Let's try and understand him.
Let me ask you this. The play was called The Radicalization, right?
Yeah.
Did you, what I might call, underline the moment when he decided to release that information or collect that information?
Yeah.
How did you stage that? I'm intrigued.
Well, it was a song and dance number, really. There was there were computers all over the set, and the actor playing Bradley sort of crouched before the computer, and a Lady Gaga track fired up. One of the reasons we couldn't archive this or post it to YouTube.
Right.
So a Lady Gaga number fired up, and the other five actors did a kind of dance number in full military uniform with carrying assault rifles, but then with wacky sunglasses or scarves or anything. So it was kind of military in drag. They did a dance number all over the stage. And then when he'd released it, when he sort of pressed the button, and he hovered over the button for quite a while, and it was, you know, he's thinking about it, and he's thinking and he's pondering the choice, but he decides to press the button, and the moment he does, that the character kind of, there's the relief sort of waves all over him, and there's a sort of wave of relief, and he starts handing out, he's got a pile of papers, and he starts handing them out to the other guys who start reading it intensely. And then, so the finale of that is they all throw the papers up in the air and they fall like confetti all over the stage and over the audience. And there's just that sense of a moment of sort of triumph and relief and celebration.
Well, with a high point like that, was that the conclusion of the piece, or what was the end of the arc?
Well, the end of the arc found him lying on a table, nothing but boxer shorts on again, with spotlights on him. And then there were a series of soldiers, US soldiers, sort of walking around the edge of the stage, just saying, prisoner, I can't remember the number, prisoner, the number, are you okay? And he would go, yeah, kind of. And then they just keep repeating that that question. Remember his constant questioning by the Marines?
Right.
You know, are you okay? Are you okay? But instead of every 5 minutes, it was every 5 seconds. And it goes on, and it goes on, and it goes on, and it goes on. I mean, it goes on so you feel it's gone on too long. You know, it's like, I think when I first saw it, I thought, wow, this is really dragging on. But in a sense...
That was the point, yeah.
That was the point, yeah. Yeah.
Amazing.
And it kind of leaves you where he is. He's incarcerated.
You know, in this country, there's a great deal of timidity in theater, by and large.
Mm-hmm.
In the area of Florida where I am, a modern theater presentation probably involves something that was originally staged in the 40s or 50s.
Sure.
And was updated in the early 60s, and it's treated as a contemporary modern piece. And don't get me started on the lack of Shakespeare over here, but that's another story entirely. I if you tried to stage that here, I could see, you know, some ignorant legislator standing on a podium somewhere and denouncing this. Did you get a negative reaction from any of the I'm sure there are some conservative members of the government over there in Wales?
Very few. And very few.
You're a lucky man, sir.
Right. I mean, you know, we're not entirely controlled by the government in Wales. They only have devolved responsibility for things like health and education. You know, the military is still UK government. So there are many, many English conservative politicians who still have a big say in how Wales is run. I mean, it's an interesting area, Haverford West, because there are people there. I mean, the biggest employer around the area is the military.
Really?
There are military bases. I mean, that's where Bradley's dad met his mum. That's how they came together. That's how Bradley comes to be. I mean, there are a lot of people involved and employed by the military. In many, you know, in today's economic climate, they're not too keen to rail against them. But there's also a radical community in that part of Wales. It's right on the far west side of the country. And somebody said, you know, it's about as far away as people can get from London and the kind of English political elite. So there are people living out there. So there was quite a strong sort of campaigning element to the people who were around the play. But, if people weren't interested, they just didn't come.
Yeah.
You know, there was only 100 tickets for each show. We were in a school hall. We had a rectangular stage, and there was about 3 seats deep on each side and both ends. So, you know, it wasn't a huge auditorium, and it was fairly blatant what the story was. And I think if people weren't interested, they wouldn't go. I don't know how conservative population in America would react to that. But
while not seeing it, they would still condemn it as the work of, probably Beelzebub or something.
Right. Well, it wasn't. It was the National Theatre of Wales. So I think if they did that, that would be a fairly upfront attack on the country of Wales.
Well, I'm sure that the spirit of Richard Burton was smiling.
Certainly. And Michael Sheen and Anthony Hopkins.
Let me ask you this. I understand that through the webcast, part of the presentation was seen by thousands of people?
10,000 people in 72 countries, which for theater is very good. I mean,
you underplay it, sir. Extraordinary.
Yeah. I mean, it was really. It's certainly something that's interesting theater makers over here. But what we were trying to do was not simply to try and recreate the theater experience, which you can't. I mean, it's a live experience, and when you're sat in a play audience, you experience that uniquely because your eyes scan around the stage. You pick up on emotions that characters that aren't the focus are displaying, and you have that direct sense of connection and often empathy with the people who are playing the parts. I mean, live theater is something profoundly different from television or film. So so is the internet. I mean, the internet is not a TV. It's not a cinema. It's a unique context for experiencing stories. So, you know, we're very conscious of the fact that, by and large, people experience things on the internet as a single person, an individual. You don't watch the internet with your family sat around you. It's a solitary experience, and inevitably it's quite intimate as a result. We made sure, for example, that you couldn't full screen the video because we didn't want people to abdicate that kind of the engagement with Bradley's story that we were trying to achieve. So you couldn't just put it on full screen, sit back and watch it. You were kind of drawn towards the chat with the rest of the audience, and you were drawn towards the links. So that, you know, there was an opportunity to interact with his story. That's what we were trying to do. We were trying to tell his story rather than to simply serve the play as it happened.
As I say, I've been involved in multimedia and mixed media since the late 60s. And I can imagine quite easily an immersive theater experience where, while not duplicating a stage experience, with, you know, three walls of interactive media, you could portray, you know, these sub feeds and as well as this variety of different content and contexts.
Sure.
It's an intriguing way of presenting material, and I wish you every, you know, success with it. And to think that this story was one of the first to be treated to this extent. I think it's amazing, and you did his story a great service by presenting.
Well, that's what we
wanted
to do. That was really what we wanted to do. This is about Bradley. It's not about the technology. It's not about what we did. It's about his story. It's about Wales saying, "Hey, he's one of us, and we care about him, and we're deeply concerned about the way he's been treated."
Let me ask you this. In this country, we've had a whole rash of whistleblowers who have been badly treated by our judicial system. We've got a CIA gentleman, Mr. Curacao, who blew the whistle on the CIA torturing, and none of the torturers but he is instead facing prison.
Sure.
And, of course, you know the story of Daniel Ellsberg.
Yeah,
been
yeah.
very much the forefront of these battles and bring people's attention to it. Mm. Are you having some of the same problems over there? I know you have a conservative government that's seeming to rattle sabers completely in time with the people over here.
Yeah, I think our security services and military are deeply synchronized and connected. I mean, I would actually look back to the Second World War for the origins of that. I mean, I grew up in southern England where the forces assembled in advance of D-Day, and I reflect on it. I think, you know, even if a politician in the UK rose to become the Prime Minister who was deeply hostile to those forms of connection, I don't think he'd last very long. I think the sort of bonding between US and UK military is so deep. It's it's slightly undemocratic in that sense. There was a play, a TV play in, I think it was the 80s, which visualized that kind of scenario of a Labour radical politician who wanted to undermine the security connection between the US and the UK, and he was essentially forced out. I mean, in terms of whistleblowers, I mean, the case of David Kelly is one that still disturbs me. I mean, that was the one that Bradley wrote about in January 2004 on his website. David Kelly is described generally as a very difficult and depressed man, but we don't know that. That is what the authorities say, and his suicide has been declared as a case of no foul play. But it was kind of declared that the day he killed himself, and I always find that suspicious. But obviously, you know, I don't think we'll learn the truth about that. We don't have any high-profile whistleblowers that you have in the military, but I mean, there's a recent case of a senior manager in the National Health Service. That's our nationalised health service, whereby if there's anything wrong with you, you can go and see a doctor for free. And as I said, that's something that we love. I don't think there are many people in Britain who would badmouth it. I don't know if you saw the Olympics opening ceremony, did you?
Yes.
There was a big part of that which was about the NHS, and you know, it was about celebrating what's great about our country, and that was a big part of the heart of that celebration. And there was a guy who was a senior manager recently who left the kind of health authority that he used to work for, and he was paid off to sign a gagging clause within a contract that he couldn't speak out on mistreatment of patients within hospitals. And he very recently he got so sick of what was happening in the hospitals that he knew about that he decided to break that. And you know, a lot of people have kind of condemned him for breaking the contract, but there is a sort of active political debate in the UK about it. I mean, what I see coming from America horrifies me. I mean, I you know, you look at the videos where people say he's a traitor, we should kill him, boom, and they said that about Assange, and they've said, I mean, I don't get how you can call a traitor Assange a traitor. He's not your citizen. I mean, that for a start, that's ridiculous. But similar things have been said about Bradley Manning. You know, he was sharing war crimes. I mean, it was the government and the military that was breaking the law. If you're saying you should be acting with integrity to your citizens, then, you know, look at Bradley. He acted with some integrity there. The way he's been treated is appalling. And the sort of hatred and vitriol he's received for that is truly scary. I mean, I look at, you know, calls for the death penalty for that young man. I mean, he's you know, he's 21 at the time. He was acting as an idealist, and you know, he's part of a new generation that has ideals. Are we going to kill them now? Are we going to squash those ideals at this early stage? I find that all very disturbing. I mean, these are my personal views, not the views of the country or the theatre company.
Right. Well, we even had our constitutional scholar president declared not only that he was guilty.
Sure, yeah.
But also that he was being treated fairly. This was during the Quantico phase of his
constitutional incarceration. Well, your constitutional president knew nothing about the truth at that point.
Or at least wasn't inclined to deal with it. Tom,
yeah.
I have to bid you farewell. I want to thank you so much for joining me. You gave us a lot to think about. And congratulations on creating such an innovative show. I only hope to hear more about the next project some other time, okay?
Well, let's not focus on me. Let's focus on Bradley for today. We should all remember he's still in prison, and he is potentially facing the rest of his life in jail.
Let's hope not.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks again, Mr. Thomas Beardshaw. Thank you so much for joining us, and let's hope that Bradley Manning is free soon. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Good. Thanks for the chat, Rick. Good to speak to you.
Take care.
Bye.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you took this time to consider what this young man is facing, simply because he wanted to make sure that we knew the truth. And I wish you all farewell. And I'm going to leave you with this thought that, ladies and gentlemen, we all are whistleblowers. We're all Bradley Manning when we tell the truth, my brothers and sisters. Solidarity and peace. Talk to you tomorrow. This is Richard Spisak, News Director of Progressive News Network, bidding you farewell.